the size of us. And I've had a few questions about that. In fact, someone came up to me and asked me if it was going to be a weight loss talk. I wish it were that simple. Tomorrow is Labor Day, a day steeped in a tradition of resistance and brotherhood, a day that honors a struggle that is still going on, the fight between labor and capitalists for how we distribute wealth. And of course, Labor Day brings up unions. Speaking of unions, I will be going to my 50th high school reunion in a month and a half. Yikes, that's a lot of history. Today, I'd like to explore with you this compulsion we have to achieve or recapture a union. What is a union, or a reunion for that matter? Looking back at high school, I'm not sure we actually had what you would call a union. No matter how old you are, you've probably experienced the cliques, the exclusions they implied, and the hurt they caused. In my day, 1964 to 1967, we had jocks, the preppies, the hoodlums, the geeks, or as we referred to them, the brainiacs, and the beginnings of what would become the hippies. I started out as a jock and ended up as a hippie with a very brief stopover among the brainiacs. The group I ended up with, the hippies, resulted in lifelong friendships that persist to this day. But here's the thing. When we get together in a month and a half, after 50 years, those cliques, those divisions, will be irrelevant. Those of us left standing will look at each other as a single group, as a union. We will be a community of souls who shared something foundational. Some of us had more fun than is legally permissible, and we hope to capture some small part of that again. Others will come hoping to heal past pains or slights, to show the cool guys and girls that, yes, they'd made it. But the divisions will matter much less than what unites us. I think I was probably one of the lucky ones. I had a pretty good time in high school, although I have to say, I have to confess that that didn't stop me from feeling a certain amount of pleasure when our student council president, quarterback, and all-around alpha male, a guy I'd been pretty good friends with, showed up at the 20th reunion as a balding, overweight insurance salesman wearing glasses. But let's get back to that idea of a union. To start with, we can examine the roots of the word union. It comes from the early Latin unus, and in later Latin, the word unio and uni evolved, meaning unity. It seems to me this root pops up in a lot of what we value. Let's run through some of the English words derived from it. Unitarian, universalist, unify, unique, unison, university, community, and ultimately, universe. Now, there's a progression here that I think tells us a lot about our history, and maybe even more about what's going on right now in this crazy and perilous time in our country. And finally, it may provide a pole star towards which we can steer ourselves, either into a dystopian future in which survival is a struggle, or toward a sustainable, prosperous, and moral future. If, as Martin Luther King said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, then I would add that this arc is fueled by an inexorable march toward greater union or community. Periodically, there are bumps in this road toward oneness, and we are in the midst of one today here in America. Let's get back to Labor Day. I described it as a day steeped in a tradition of resistance and brotherhood, a day that honors a struggle that is still going on. At the turn of the last century, labor was cheap and the lives of laborers cheaper yet. Children worked long hours in factories, as did their parents. Conditions were dangerous, pay was low, and capitalists were amassing huge amounts of wealth at the expense of labor. For example, from 1860 to 1900, the wealthiest 2% of American households owned more than a third of the nation's wealth, while the top 10% owned roughly 3/4 of it. The bottom 40% had no wealth at all. In terms of property, the wealthiest 1% owned half of all property, while the bottom 44% claimed just 1%. And these statistics are being recreated today. The systems trapped people in cesspools of inequality. The truck system and debt bondage were often used to control labor. Under this economic model, workers lived in houses owned by the company, shopped in stores owned by the company, and got paid in scrip, minted by the company. And no matter how hard they worked, they remained indebted to the company. The truck system survived in the US until the 1930s. This kind of abuse was the direct result of an us versus them mentality. By the 1930s, through the efforts of people like Joe Hill, Mother Jones, Eugene Debs, and Samuel Gompers, labor was on a more equal footing with capitalism. It succeeded because people came together to form unions. They saw strength in numbers and in unity. But it was an epic struggle, and it remains so today, as inequality once again raises to levels that are unconscionable and immoral. It brings to mind one of my favorite quotes on struggles from Frederick Douglass. Here's what he said. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. But I've only recently come to understand something very important about this struggle. We like to think of our march through time as one of conflict and conquest, fueled by Darwin's survival of the fittest, a grim struggle, red in tooth and claw, as Hobbes put it. The question is, does every act of union require an other? Can there only be an us if we have a them? Must this struggle pit us one against another? I would argue that we have a choice. We can make this struggle a work toward a greater union, a shared community that grows inexorably larger and more inclusive, or we can make it about choosing sides and lining up one against another. Understood in this way, Frederick Douglass's struggle cannot be simply to beat the other. It must be to make the other one with us. It is to work towards the larger we, not to diminish the them. As Abraham Lincoln said, "Do I not destroy my enemy when I make him my friend?" But our models for how the world works tells us that competition is the driving force and that leads to advancement. We see evolution as survival of the fittest. We see our economic models as based on competition and the ruthless drive to exploit each other, nature, even our children's future. And certainly there is some truth to this view. But it is not the whole truth. The drive toward union, toward oneness, informs everything about us. Our evolution, our economic models, our social structures, our moral compass. Indeed, it is hardwired into our very DNA and has been from the earliest, and it has been from the earliest forms of life on Earth. The tension between the world defined by the singularity of the individual competing and triumphing versus a world based on the Enlightenment concept of a commonwealth or the collective good is at the heart of the great political and moral struggles we see in our nation right now. We are all too familiar with those arguments about survival of the fittest and the notion of a market fueled by greed, a world of Marlboro men and predators driven by individual self-interest, a world in which notions of we are subordinated, a world where we are confronted by a struggle against 1,000 thems who we must vanquish if we are to prosper. This is a world that many of our politicians inhabit right now. This is a world that thrives on hate, fear, greed, divisiveness, jingoism, racism, and sexism. or any of a thousand other isms that turn us one against another. It is the world that dominates our political and philosophical worldview at the moment. This world is mean, it's nasty, it's brutish, and it's self-terminating, defined by the calculus of strife and the philosophy of conquest. But there is a compelling alternative, a reality in which the world is shaped by a drive for cooperation, community, and unity. And this drive extends from the earliest and simplest single-celled life forms on Earth to the vast, unfathomable reaches of the universe. This reality is embedded in a fundamental truth. Life has evolved as much through cooperation and union as it has conquest. And this reality is universal. It is why history's arc bends towards justice, why ultimately strategies based on community and union will triumph going forward into the mists of time. The only question for humanity is whether we will be a part of this march or a bit of detritus left on evolution's trail, sacrificed on the altar of individualism and self-interest. Essayist Lewis Thomas caught this tension in his book, The Lives of a Cell, when he said, "But it is illusion to think that there is anything fragile about life on Earth. Surely this is the toughest membrane imaginable in the universe, opaque to probability, impermeable to death. We are the fragile part, transient and as vulnerable as cilia." I'd like to take you a little further into the short, if tedious, trip about the science of this. So please bear with me, because there is a lot of real science backing up this march towards unity. Evolutionary biologist Lynn Margolis put it best. "Life on Earth is such a good story, you cannot afford to miss the beginning. Beneath our superficial differences, we are all of us walking communities of bacteria. The world shimmers, a pointless landscape made of many living things. And each exists because it has cooperated and joined and formed a union." As Margolis discovered, the evolution of the life itself is just as much a story of union, communion, and community as it is of one of competition and speciation. The basic building blocks of plants and animals are a tribute to this cooperation and this drive toward community. One of the most important advances in evolution, and it was a giant step forward, was the development of what are called eukaryotic cells. And this was a result of symbiosis. These more advanced cells, which made plants and animals possible and which fueled the diversity of life we see here on Earth today, are a result of the union between two much simpler and more primitive cellular structures called prokaryotes. And from that union, from that advance, life grew in complexity and sophistication. Without it, none of us would be here. Similarly, mitochondria, which allow us to harness energy and enabled much more complex life forms, are a result of genetic stowaways. Mitochondria has its own DNA, distinct and apart from yours and ours. As are chloroplasts, which enable photosynthesis. Each operates in an intimate partnership at the cellular level with us, their hosts. Fast forward a few billion years, and we are only now learning that the 100 trillion bacteria we have in our guts, 3 pounds of genetic, symbiotic stowaways, are critical to our survival, aiding in everything from digestion to how our immune systems function to our mental health. Our lives depend upon cooperation with literally aliens. The point is, harmony and union have been as elemental in forming life as competition and strife. And the same has been true of human culture. We've gone from social structures defined by prehistoric genetic kinships measured in a dozen or so individuals to nation states numbering in the billions. And at each stage, The idea of who we define as we and us has grown with it. But for the last 40 years here in the US, we've gone from ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, to I alone can fix it. Now we build walls between our neighbors, between each other, between ourselves, and between our children yet unborn. Our culture today is defined by an economic and moral model that splinters society into more and more groups, each of which looks at the other as a them. Both political parties subscribe to this notion, although one has raised it to an almost religious zealotry. It is the antithesis of a commonwealth and the civil society it creates. In fact, it is a society as a zero-sum game, and it creates a culture that is functionally like that of Lord of the Flies. Adolescent, violent, cliquish, competitive, and dangerous. The Dalai Lama speaks often on the need for a global community and the sense of a universal responsibility. There's that Latin word again, uni. Here's what he said at the United Nations World Conference on Human Rights over two decades ago. As the 20th century draws to a close, we find that the world has grown smaller and the world's people have become almost one community. People and military alliances have created large multinational groups. Industry and international trade have produced a global economy, and worldwide communications are eliminating ancient barriers of distance, language, and race. We are also being drawn together by the grave problems we face: overpopulation, dwindling natural resources, and an environmental crisis that threatens our air, our water, our trees, along with the vast number of beautiful life forms that are the very foundation of existence on this small planet we share. The Dalai Lama went on to say, "I believe that to meet the challenge of our times, human beings will have to develop a greater sense of universal responsibility. Each of us must learn to work not just for his or her own self, family, or nation, but for the benefit of all mankind. Universal responsibility is the key to human survival. It is the best foundation for world peace, the equitable use of natural resources, and through concern for future generations, the proper care of our environment." This, then, is the true nature of Frederick Douglass's struggle to form a more perfect union. Ah, but how do we do it? Well, it is a matter of survival. Perhaps humanity is merely in its adolescence, and this current stage is nothing but a tantrum in the longer arc of our existence. But here's the thing. I believe that next month, if the hoodlums and the brainiacs and the preppies and the jocks and the hippies can come together as one after the passage of a mere 50 years, then there's hope for us to do it on the scale needed to survive. Last week, the Voyager spacecrafts celebrated their 40th year in space. As they were leaving our solar system, Carl Sagan persuaded the mission commanders to turn the cameras around and snap a picture of Earth. On Valentine's Day in 1990, Voyager 1 took a picture of what has become known as the pale blue dot. Sagan wrote an essay that is perhaps one of the most beautiful and inspiring compositions ever penned, and in it may be the key to moving towards this greater we, this larger us. The understanding of how gloriously insignificant are those things which divide us. I'm going to read this essay in its entirety. It's not that long. But I must warn you, there's a good chance I'm going to break down when I do. I don't know why that happens. I've never successfully read the entire thing without breaking down. So if it happens, just bear with me, and I might even call Linda up to finish it. Here's what he said. "From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest, but for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joys and suffering, Thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we must make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. May it be so.